Today is Wednesday, the 21st of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Iraqi Prime Minister fires security officials after a deadly blast in Sadr City.
Qasemi's destitution of top security officials following the explosion indicates internal tensions within those forces.
Plus, Haiti's new prime minister is sworn in as more arrests are made in the investigation of the former president's assassination.
He announces 3 arrests, 2 police officers and 1 civilian.
We'll have these stories and more next. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa Kadhimi has fired security officials after at least 34 people were killed and over 50 were wounded in an explosion on Monday night, according to the Iraqi media. The Islamic State militant group claimed responsibility for the attack that Iraqi security officials say was committed by a suicide bomber. Edward Uranian starts us off.
A crowd of mostly women shoppers ran for cover amid screaming and yelling following an explosion Monday night at a crowded clothing market in Baghdad's mostly Shiite Sadr city. It was the third such attack in Iraq this year. Another attack in Sadr city in January left around 30 dead. A group of young men dressed in black loaded coffins onto vehicles in preparation for burial Tuesday morning. A middle-aged woman dressed in black bewailed some of the young victims of the explosion. A young man with a yellow cap complained on social media that attacks on markets targeting civilians are all too common in Iraq before major religious holidays like Eid al-Adha, which began Tuesday. He says that this kind of thing always happens to us before elections and before the Eids. Most of the victims, he points out, were women and children. Iraqi TV's correspondent in Sadr City reported that the explosive vest worn by the suicide bomber contained nails and ball bearings to increase the number of victims, according to eyewitnesses. Prime Minister Mustafa Qasemi fired security officials responsible for the area in Sadr City where Monday's explosion took place. Hours before the blast, Qasemi said in an interview he hoped Muqtada Sadr, a top Shiite political leader, many of whose followers live in Sadr city, would reverse his decision not to participate in the upcoming October parliamentary elections. He says that we must encourage Muqtada Sadr to reverse his decision not to participate in the elections. Other political forces were trying to make his group pay for its mistakes, but everyone in Iraq, he insists, must be held responsible for his mistakes. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that internal political tensions between Prime Minister Qasemi and various political groups could be behind the recent activities of Islamic State. He questions whether under the banner of Islamic State, there aren't in reality various Iraqi political forces that are battling Qasemi, given that the centralized Islamic State group in its former incarnation no longer exists. Abu Diab also points out that Qasemi's destitution of top security officials following the explosion indicates internal tensions within those forces, with some of those officials loyal to other political leaders. Paul Sullivan, a Washington-based Middle East analyst, tells VOA that the nightmarish attack on the market in Sadr City as people were shopping for the Eid has the hallmarks of Islamic State, and he thinks the attack was meant to fuel the flames of sectarian strife in Iraq and split the country. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that Islamic State has been active in blowing up electricity pylons, attacking Iraqi security forces, and carrying out 3 suicide attacks since January. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Just before Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani was to lead Eid celebrations Tuesday morning in Kabul, several rockets hit the city's fortified so-called green zone. Joining us with the details of the attack is Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad.
Well, this was, first of all, before he was due to give his speech, there was this congregation at the presidential palace. You know, the Eid day starts with a major prayer. And Ghani and all his aides and senior politicians were inside the presidential palace offering the prayer. And it was being shown live on all the television stations, including the state TV, RTA. And that's when suddenly there was a big boom and, you know, several rockets hit the what is called the Green Zone area in Kabul, which is not far from the presidential palace. And we could see, you know, the television stations continued with their footage, and we could see that some people were really scared after they heard these rocket attack noises. And then, but the prayers continued. And now we know for sure that the Islamic State's local affiliate in Afghanistan, this is called Khorasan province, has claimed responsibility for launching this attack.
Now, the initial reporting was that there were no casualties associated with the attack. Is that still the case?
That is the case, because it just these rockets fell in an area where there was no population or no facilities. So it was just like, it seems that they were just some kind of warning shots or just creating terror. That was it, because it didn't hurt anybody. We don't have any reports as of this moment of any casualty.
Now, this attack was claimed by the local Islamic State group, as you mentioned, but the Taliban continues their offensive throughout the country. What is the latest situation on the ground as NATO and U.S. forces near the completion of their withdrawal?
Well, this is an interesting situation today that we have come to know, and that is that there were peace talks going on in Qatar 2 days ago between the Afghan government delegation and the Taliban leaders. And everybody was anticipating that there may be some kind of an announcement about the Eid ceasefire, that, you know, this is a 3-day festival, so there would be no offensive operations from either the Taliban or the Afghan government forces. But there was no agreement announced about this ceasefire from the Taliban side. Before interacting with you, I just spoke to Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen in Doha, the capital of Qatar, and he confirmed to me that although they did not announce a ceasefire, but as he put it, there is a de facto ceasefire for the next 3 days, including today, in Afghanistan from the Taliban side. And that is why we have not seen any incident of violence on the battlefield or elsewhere in the country, some kind of bombing, bomb attacks. There was absolute silence today. In fact, the Taliban social media accounts and their spokespeople were releasing information to journalists through their official accounts about how the Taliban were maintaining peace in areas that have they have taken control of in recent weeks. So some kind of some sort of a propaganda campaign was there, that there is total peace and no violence. And that is true, that neither the government side in Kabul reported any attack on their forces, nor the Taliban have talked about any attacks on their position by the Afghan government.
Reporter Ayaz Ghul joined us from Islamabad, Pakistan. 20 years after freeing Afghanistan from the grip of the Taliban, U.S. and NATO troops are leaving. For a generation of Afghans who grew up during this time, the future is worrisome. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has that part of the story.
Recently, on the streets of Kandahar, a Humvee carrying Afghan special forces came under attack from Taliban fighters. The next day, the Taliban reportedly raised their signature white flag over a key border crossing with Pakistan. This video comes from a Taliban spokesman, and VOA cannot independently verify its content, but it claims to show an unnamed Taliban fighter at the border pledging the group's commitment to safeguarding Afghan security forces and local businesses. But many Afghans see the Taliban as a threat to their way of life. Medina Sadat is a civil rights activist and mother of two. She lives in Kabul and says the mood in Afghanistan is changing.
When the U.S. and NATO and European countries got involved in Afghanistan, people started to live normal lives. But when foreign agencies decided to leave Afghanistan, a fear spread, especially among women. We are worried about what will happen to us and what will happen to our family members in the future.
Meanwhile, from his shop in Kabul, Murtaza, who has only been in business for a year, has his own concerns as a small business owner.
We want a better future, a future without war, without coronavirus, and without steep prices, because we all want a peaceful life.
He adds that uncertainty for his business rises as the Taliban's footprint grows.
I must say I'm very worried. Maybe many problems will multiply, and maybe I won't be able to support my family. Our biggest fear is that if the Taliban enter Kabul, it will create massive fear and terror in people's minds and drive them away from their homes.
Murtaza says the international community should do more to pressure the Taliban into joining a peace process with the Afghan government. Medina Sadat doesn't see that happening.
Taliban are the same as they were 20 years ago. The ideology is the same as before. Life under Taliban rule is like you are in a cage, especially for women. Like mothers around the world, I want the best life for my kids, a better and bright future. But I don't see that for kids with the Taliban's comeback. I worry their basic rights will be violated. I am fearful for my son, but even more worried about my daughter.
The Biden administration pledged ongoing financial support for the Afghan government, but those living increasingly close to the violence with memories of life under Taliban rule are concerned that pledge may not be enough. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Haiti's Prime Minister-designate, Ariel Henry, was sworn into office on Tuesday. He replaced Dr. Claude Joseph, who had been serving as the country's interim prime minister since the July 7th assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. Joining me from Port-au-Prince is reporter Handy Tiebert with more on the transition of power.
Ariel Henry is a politician. You know, he's been in politics for quite a few years, and his work at some level in government administration, not in this government administration, but past government administration. At some point, he was part of the opposition to Jovenel Moïse. So choosing Ariel Henry, that was the last big decision that President Jovenel Moïse took before he was assassinated, like 2 days before he was assassinated. He chooses Ariel Henry to be prime minister to replace Dr. Claude Joseph because he wanted to open the door for the opposition. He wanted to have a consensus between, you know, the government and the opposition so he can have more people take part of the coming elections. Because that was one of the requirements from the international communities, the United Nations and, you know, the US, France, Canada, and the what they call the core group. So that was one of the requirements. He needed to surround himself with more and more people from all branches of the opposition, the civil community, you know, the entrepreneur, and everybody kind of have like a big diversity of people representing in the new government that he wanted to form. So that's why he chose Ariel Henry to be the new prime minister. But in his cabinet, he still have at least 7 ministers who worked with the past government over Jovenel Moïse. So it's an opening to the opposition. There are some opposition leaders in this new cabinet. There are some people from the civilian community, from some entrepreneur part of this government. But we still have a kind of continuity with a lot of people from Jovenel's party, PHTK. And the mission of this government, we have only one mission: make sure there's an election before the end of the year, so we can have a new president by February 7th, 2022.
Handy, Tuesday also saw the announcement by the officials there conducting the investigation into the assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse that at least 3 people had been arrested. What can you tell us about them and the status of the investigation?
Today, the chief of police, he announced he confirmed 3 arrests. There was a press conference on Tuesday. He announced 3 arrests. 2 police officers named Bonnie Gregoire and Clifton Hippolyte, and 1 civilian named Dominique Covin. So all these people, they were arrested because they participated in some meetings. They participated in like a lot of meetings with the commando, Colombians, and other people that were previously arrested, including Christian Emmanuel Sanon, who was appointed as the intellectual commander of the assassination. So these people, they were arrested because they have connections with the people that were previously arrested, and they participated in a lot of meetings with these people in planification of the assassination. And they still have three people of interest. They issue some warrants for them. One of them is called John Joel Joseph. He's a former senator. He was senator during the presidency of René Préval. He was senator twice. We also have Rudolf Ja, who is an entrepreneur. He owns a few businesses, a few big enterprises here in Haiti. And also they're looking at Félix Roberto Badiou. Félix Roberto Badiou is very interesting because they point him as the leader, as the one who gave the order to kill the president. What we know is that a lot of arrests have been made, like seven for now. But in the population, in the general population, you know, 2 weeks later, the people in the streets, they are asking for answers. They want to understand. They want to know exactly what happened.
Handy Tiebert in Port-au-Prince. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has issued a warning about the misuse of surveillance technology in the wake of reports spyware was used to hack smartphones of human rights activists, business executives, and journalists. Michelle Bachelet says the illegitimate use of such tools could undermine people's human rights and subvert democratic societies. Lisa Schlein is up next.
It is not yet clear to what extent the Pegasus spyware sold by the Israeli firm NSO Group has been used to spy on journalists, human rights defenders, opposition politicians, and others. But Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet finds revelations that the telephones of some 50,000 people were hacked into extremely alarming. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, calls the emerging information hugely disturbing and notes it may just be the tip of the iceberg. He tells VOA the people whose phones were hacked are not Islamic State terrorists or criminals. He says they are journalists, human rights activists, and others engaged in legitimate activities.
It's very scary. The potential is very severe, and I think a wake-up call to everyone that we need to do something about this. We need to find some way of controlling this, of putting this genie back into the bottle, because it's potentially hugely intrusive and hugely dangerous in some cases for many of us.
In a statement, High Commissioner Bachelet expresses her misgivings about the use of these deeply intrusive surveillance tools. She says they can only be justified in cases of investigations in serious crimes and grave security threats. She notes if the recent allegations about the use of Pegasus are even partly true, then that red line has been crossed again and again with total impunity. Spokesman Colville says the surveillance tools reportedly have been used to arrest, intimidate, and even kill journalists and human rights defenders. He says the potential for abuse of this software is huge and very dangerous.
You can get people who are simply spying on any politician, on any kind of opposition whatsoever, in order to stay in power. And that, of course, is perhaps the most alarming thing overall. This can be used to subvert democracy, to subvert all sorts of human rights, freedom of expression, freedom of opinion, right to privacy, and in extreme cases, right to life.
Bachelet says companies that develop and distribute surveillance technologies are responsible for avoiding harm to human rights. She says they must take immediate steps to mitigate and remedy the harms caused by their products. She says states need to enact laws to make companies legally accountable for the illegitimate usage of their technology. She adds states urgently need to better regulate the sale, transfer, and use of surveillance technology to ensure it complies with human rights law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has ruled out a reunification of Cyprus and is calling for a two-state solution, a move that threatens to escalate tensions in the eastern Mediterranean. Dorian Jones takes it from here.
Turkish Cypriots on Tuesday celebrated the 47th anniversary of Turkey's invasion of Cyprus. Despite ongoing reunification efforts by the United Nations, the island has remained divided between Greek and Turkish Cypriots. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, speaking at the commemorations, blamed Greek Cypriots for the failed reunification effort and called for a new approach. Ankara only recognizes a Turkish Cypriot state, while much of the rest of the world recognizes the Greek Cypriot administration. The European Union, which includes Cyprus, vehemently opposes any move to recognize a Turkish Cypriot state. But political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Athens University says Erdogan's stance is unlikely to result in any repercussions from the EU. The EU and Washington say they are committed to backing UN efforts for a reunified island that protects the rights of both communities. Domestic politics could be a factor behind Erdogan's stance. With support failing due to a lagging economy, analysts say the Turkish president is betting that a tough stance on Cyprus will play well with his Turkish nationalist voting base. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
China's foreign ministry has rejected allegations by the United States and other countries that it was behind a computer hacking campaign. Ministry spokesperson Zhao Li Zhan calls the accusation a fabrication and said it came out of thin air. He told reporters during a regular press briefing on Tuesday, China will absolutely not accept this and that China does not engage in cyber attacks. The U.S. also charged four Chinese nationals for cyber crimes. The White House says that it is exploring ways the United States can aid the people of Cuba engaging in anti-government protests and also hold the Cuban government accountable for repressing freedom on the island nation. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on Tuesday that the U.S. is looking to increase Cuba's internet access, boost humanitarian assistance, and devise a workable remittance system for family members. The Tokyo Olympics are set to open on Friday, but the chief of the organizing committee declined on Tuesday to rule out a last-minute cancellation if the number of COVID-19 cases among athletes continues to spike. There are currently 71 coronavirus cases already reported since July 1st of people accredited to participate in the games or be there in some capacity. The United States confirms that it has carried out the first airstrike under the Biden administration against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The United States has frequently carried out such strikes, but has not done so since January 19. The Pentagon said the strike occurred near Galkayo. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Witnesses say that two people attempted to stab the interim president of Mali and coup leader Colonel Assimi Goïta at the Great Mosque of Bamako. Andy Reisenberg has the details.
Two men armed with knives attempted to stab Mali's transitional president, Colonel Assimi Goïta, Tuesday morning in Bamako's central mosque after Eid al-Adha prayers, according to a freelance reporter who was present for the morning prayers. Eid al-Adha, known as Tabaski in Mali, is one of the most celebrated holidays in the country. Goïta was not injured in the attack, and the assailants were apprehended by security forces. Assimi Goïta was a leader in the August 2020 coup, which deposed former Malian president Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta. He became interim president after another military coup in May of this year, which deposed the then-interim civilian president Ba Diaw. Elections are scheduled for February 2022. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Following the 44-day war between Armenia and Azerbaijan in 2020, a fragile peace between the two nations continues to hold. But in some communities, that ceasefire has created new problems. Anna Rice narrates this story.
In 2020, 44 days of fighting between Turkey-supported Azerbaijan and the Armenian-supported Republic of Nagorno-Karabakh left thousands of people dead. A Russian-brokered ceasefire left Azerbaijan in control of a large swath of new territory. For the residents of the Armenian village of Shurnukh, the ceasefire and the new borders have created an uncomfortable new normal. Half of the village remains on the Azerbaijani side of the new border established by the ceasefire. The other half of the village is on the Armenian side, with Russian peacekeepers sandwiched between the two. Today, dozens of families in Shurnukh are homeless because of the fighting and the new boundaries. The Armenian government has promised to build new homes for those families on its side of the border. But the idea of having Azerbaijani neighbors is troubling to some of the Armenian villagers.
I can speak for myself, and that is unimaginable.
In the Armenian village of Vorotan, the street signs are in both Armenian and Azerbaijani.
We live in uncertainty. The future here is vague. The nights are full of fear.
And for some people, the new borders have affected their ability to make a living.
We have no pastures. Why else would I live here if my cattle have no place to graze?
And for some Armenians, Russian involvement is the last thing they want.
Of course we are afraid. It is a symbol of fear.
Even though the violence has ended, some people living in the region are still uncertain about the future as they try to live on the new front lines of this long simmering conflict. For VOA Armenian, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Billionaire Amazon founder Jeff Bezos blasted off into space on his own rocket ship for a brief suborbital flight on Tuesday. And Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker has that story.
Command engine start. 2-1.
That was Blue Origin's rocket taking off from Texas with Bezos, along with his brother and also an 18-year-old whose dad paid for him to go, and an 82-year-old woman, once a NASA pilot, denied a chance to go to space because she was a woman. 10 minutes later, they all landed.
Welcome back, New Shepard.
The capsule separating from the rocket, floating to the ground with parachutes.
Blue controlled Bezos' best day ever.
They reached an altitude of about 66 miles. That's further than fellow billionaire Richard Branson got on his space trip about a week ago. Blue Origin plans two more trips with customers this year. I'm Julie Walker.
And finally, from smartphones to billboards, digital displays are everywhere. But some companies say the ideal display is the human eye itself, and they're developing some eye-opening smart contact lenses. Tina Tren rounds us out.
We consult screens every day for information, but what if that experience could be delivered straight to your eyes? That's what some companies are hoping to accomplish with smart contact lenses. Lenses in which a user's field of vision is overlaid with digital information.
You can walk around with a heads-up display 24/7 in your eyes.
It may seem like a far-off concept, but engineers at startups are already developing smart lenses that marry augmented reality with everyday contact lenses. Michael Hayes is with Inwith Corporation, which created a prototype using a Bausch & Lomb lens.
We started from the safety and the efficacy of contact lenses as they are now, and then we worked out how to integrate circuitry into those kind of lenses.
Smart contact lens makers say their discrete appearance is a major draw.
There's no geek factor to it. When Google Glass came out a few years ago, people didn't want to adopt it because of the fact of the aesthetics.
While Inwith works with soft contact lenses, another company uses a more rigid medical-grade lens. Steve Sinclair of MojoVision says the custom-fitted Mojo lens is all about invisible computing.
We should be able to get the information we want when we want it, but also stay engaged with the real world.
MojoVision claims to have made the world's smallest and densest micro-LED display.
We can pass data wirelessly to that display, and it projects it onto your retina.
Both Inwith and MojoVision's lenses work in tandem with the user's smartphone to relay information to the lens. MojoLens has built-in motion and image sensors.
It's all about eye tracking and understanding your intent. And when you're not interested in that information, it just disappears.
It'll likely be years before consumers can test drive these lenses, but the technology is already proving they're more than meets the eye. Tina Trin, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events by visiting our website, voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.